Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
We're turning now to the life and times of Arthur Ashe, because he passed away this month 25 years ago. It's the 25-year anniversary of Arthur Ashe's death. He's obviously synonymous with Arthur Ashe Stadium at the US Open, Flushing Meadows, which tends to crop up every year. But to tell you the truth, we didn't all know a huge amount about him really in the office, and he lived a fairly extraordinary life and played through an extraordinary time in the civil rights movement in the US. He won the US Open as an amateur. He stayed amateur for slightly longer than usual. He was in the US Army as an amateur in 1968. He won the Australian Open in 1970, and then he won his third and final Grand Slam. That was in 1975 against Jimmy Connors. And his life ultimately ended in fairly tragic circumstances. A blood transfusion resulted in him contracting HIV. He ultimately passed away from pneumonia. He once told a childhood friend that he wanted to be the Jackie Robinson of tennis, although didn't seem like the most vociferous activist during his playing days. That seemed to happen later on in his life. So there is much to talk about. We're joined on the line by the perfect guest to tell us about Arthur Ashe. That is Arnold Rampersad. And Arnold Rampersad worked with Arthur Ashe on his memoir, Days of Grace, which was published the year after Ashe died. So they worked on this right through Arthur Ashe's final years. So, Arnold, you're very welcome to the show. You might tell us, I mean, what an extraordinary thing for you to work with Arthur Ashe in the final 18 months, year of his life or so. How do you remember him as a person from that period?
Well, I remember him as a man of a sort of enormous dignity, warmth, except when he was not warm, which had nothing to do with his being standoffish particularly or hostile, anything like that. Mm. But he was of course, one has to remember that he was in the last year of his life. He probably didn't know it, but in those days, and you had full-blown AIDS as he had, the expectancy was 5 years, and he was beginning that fifth year when we began work on the book. I thought he was a wonderful person. I thought he was enormously sensitive and kind. There was a loneliness to him, however, a loneliness that you couldn't really escape seeing. But he tried to bridge that by being always generous and warm-hearted in so far as he could be, given the situation he was in.
And when you say the loneliness, do you mean because of his AIDS or something more permanent than that?
Not at all. I don't think it had much to do with his AIDS. In fact, I asked him once if he tossed and turned at night because of his AIDS, and he said, no, he slept like the proverbial babe. I think, and I mean, I tried to bring this out of him in the course of writing the memoir, that it had to do with the death of his mother when he was a boy. His father brought him up and brought him up, you know, splendidly as far as he was able to go, but I think that there remained that loneliness in him. I once asked him, Arthur, do you ever think about your mother? And he said, do I ever think about my mother? I think about my mother every day. Mm. Every day. So I think he lived constantly with a sense of loss, even as he made a fair amount of money and also won all sorts of trophies and so on, including, of course, Wimbledon.
Yeah. He was just 6 years old when she passed away. And seeing as we've raised the issue of the end of his life, Ashe was diagnosed, as I understand it, in 1988. With as being HIV positive. That was after a blood transfusion. He had heart issues earlier in across that decade, and a blood transfusion went awry for whatever reason, and he ended up with HIV. That's the short version.
That is the short version. That's all I know about it, really. I asked him once, Arthur, do you wonder if people think that you're gay, or, that you had a gay episode? And he said, oh, yes, I expect people, some people will think that. But it was a blood transfusion that wasn't absolutely necessary. It was a doctor suggested that this would speed up his recovery from a procedure or an operation, and he said, oh, yes, let's do that. Mm. He was a very good patient, Ash was. He was meticulous in following instructions, and he had some of the best doctors in the U.S. working on him near the end of his life, trying to deal with AIDS.
That is a particularly tough fate to swallow, not least when, as you say there, it wasn't an absolutely necessary transfusion. Was he bitter about it? Was he angry about it?
No, he was not bitter. At least he showed no bitterness to me. He wasn't morose. He wasn't resentful. This was life. He accepted it as his fate. He didn't want to die, but no, he carried on. In fact, the last gesture he made, so I am told, reliable sources, when people looked in on him as he was lying in his hospital room, was that characteristic gesture you make with your forefinger and thumb, at least in this country, to say everything is fine, I'm okay, and that was how he went out, saying that everything was fine, it was okay.
USA Today effectively forced him to go public in 1992 to publicly announce he had contracted HIV.
Yes, and he didn't like that. He was a very private man, an unostentatious man, and he didn't like the fact that he was to be outed. And so he hastily called a news conference and announced it himself. But yes, he was outed and didn't like it.
Just for younger listeners, because I suspect, I mean, it's 25 years since his death, and obviously his tennis career predates that by a number of years, to say the least. So to give them a flavour of his voice, this, if it's not too poignant a thing to do, he passed away on February 6, 1993, and that same day he was due to be speaker at a Connecticut forum on HIV and AIDS, and he knew he couldn't attend the event, so he recorded a video message just 2 days before that, on February 4th, to be played out to the crowd. It was recorded in his home. We just came across it on YouTube. Here's some of that message, which was played out to the crowd.
My own personal experience of living with this situation for now 4.5 years, even finding some solace in the fact that, based on expectations back in September of 88, when I found out I had AIDS, that I am a long-term survivor. Most people don't even get this far. I'm now quite familiar with many of the problems, medical and otherwise, that AIDS patients have to go through. There is still a tremendous amount of work to be done with the public to assure them that ordinary contact with people like myself poses absolutely no danger to them. I can sneeze in their presence, I can cough in their presence, we can drink out of the same glass, we can use the same knife, fork, or spoon, we can kiss, and you're not going to transmit the virus. You cannot get this virus. No need to worry about that. Lastly, AIDS patients are not to be pitied. None of us want pity. We do want compassion, we do want understanding. Life is going to be difficult enough as it is without people engaging in acts of violence against us. Again, thanks for your patience. I am sorry I could not be there in person, but I hope this tape and my message in a small way makes up for my lack of being there in person. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you all. It's my sad task to try to make an announcement to you. I've asked Gina and Doris to join me, and I'm not sure that I'm strong enough to make this announcement. I'm going to read an item off of the Associated Press wire. At 3:15 today, Arthur Ashe died of pneumonia and other complications from his battle with AIDS. And I'm very sorry for Arthur and his family.
Amazing moment. That's Richard Sugarman, who was then forced to announce that the crowd that Ash had passed away. Obviously, Arnold, a few things strike you about the video. I'm sure you're familiar with it. One, and it's very clear to hear when he talks about, you know, even differentiating between pity and compassion, and just his general eloquence is the clear intelligence of the man. Also, the lack of awareness of HIV and AIDS, and that you can sneeze and cough, and just that there was that level of fear about how contagious HIV was at the time. And then thirdly, he did not look like a man with full-blown AIDS who was on death's door.
No, he did not. And that adds to the, you know, the absolute poignancy of that moment. No, he carried himself as best he could, bravely, strongly. He walked firmly. He talked, as you heard him speaking just now, with authority in his voice, modulation, and so on. And his education shows through his eloquence. He's there,
yeah.
Absolutely, except that he's slipping away even as he spoke, and he knew it. I think. I believe that he didn't know to the end that he was going.
Ash won a US Open in 1968 as an amateur. He won the Australian Open in 1970. And then at the age of 32, he beat Jimmy Connors and became the first black man to win a Wimbledon singles title in 1975. And there was no love lost between Connors and Ash at the time. And there is three massive moments. How good a tennis player was he, and what type? What was his style? He seemed to be a serve and volley man. But how would you sum up the Arthur Ashe tennis style, Arnold?
Well, how, and I've summed it up in this way as a kind of paradox. He was in real life restrained, as I've said, not cold. The cover of Life magazine. He was on the cover once, and I absolutely remembered over the years, without reference, without being stimulated, as it were, what the caption read. The caption read, "The icy elegance of Arthur Ashe." Mm. So there was a sense of ice about him, but he was transformed once he took to the tennis court. He became much more swashbuckling, much more adventurous. His natural physical grace came out. He was also an excellent sportsman. He was a very good tennis player, a forceful one. His nemesis, but that was Rod Laver. I'm not sure he ever beat Rod Laver. But he was also a very cerebral tennis player, although he was serve and volley and looking to make beautiful shots. He thought, especially in that Wimbledon victory, of course, he had his advisors. There were many people pulling for him and trying to get him over that hurdle so he could win what he regarded as the greatest prize of his tennis career. Mm. I think he had a very successful tennis career. You'd have to say that. And he took enormous satisfaction from what he had achieved on the court. Although, incidentally, that's tied to what he took to be the greatest shame of his life. And that is that he was playing tennis in the 60s when people were being beat up in the South, for example, over the question of race, and people were resisting in the case of the Vietnam War. He felt very ashamed of that, and I think that led him later in life to become more active politically, to be arrested, for example, in demonstrations involving the status of people from Haiti and other sort of political provocations, as you saw them.
Yeah. So you've raised just a massively interesting area there in Arthur Ashe's life. Before we get on to, so I mean, you'd think, I mentioned he won his first Grand Slam, his US Open in 1968 is synonymous with John Carlos and Tommy Smith and the games in Mexico and just the general civil rights movement in America at the time. We'll come to that in one second. If we flip back for a second, the interesting thing about Ash is he was born in Richmond, Virginia. It is, I mean, Richmond, Virginia, this is the capital of Confederacy in the Civil War. It's still segregated post-World War II. Ash is born in 1943, so still segregated. They're in schools, restrooms, bathrooms, buses, water fountains. That time in Virginia, it was still a ruthless time. There were lynchings, there were killings, and it seems, so his mother passed away when he's six. His father was strict, and it seems imbued Ash to fight all the stereotypes, to be mannerly at all times, to never argue a call on the tennis court, return a shot even if it's 2 inches out over the line, and also just generally, because this was potentially life or death, don't fight back, be passive. Was actually an important survival skill. That's the environment Arthur Ashe was born into.
That's true. To be fair, and I don't know that, I mean, I lived a couple of years in Virginia, in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia. It is a genteel culture, and it considers itself a sort of an aristocratic culture almost, and so in a way Arthur was raised to be a gentleman in that tradition. That tradition perhaps was often more in the imagination than in reality. But he was, yes, he was taught by his father, who was conservative, as many African Americans in the South were and are. He was conservative, his father was, and trained him to be also conservative, and Ash responded by being conservative in many respects. But a lot of his life, once he got into his 20s and early 30s and so on, was not a rebellion, because I don't think he was capable of rebellious acts, but I mean, he tried to move as far away from that culture as he could, even though he always played in the Richmond Open. When he was growing up, I mean, and into his young manhood, he was ranked nationally, but could not play in the top tournaments in Richmond itself. But
because of his skin color, obviously.
But he returned to play as if nothing had happened, almost, if you wanted to call it that. I was at his funeral in Richmond, and it was a tremendous turnout of black people, but also of white people. I think his father would have been very happy about it. Arthur was, I think, on balance, satisfied with the way he had played that particular game, as it were, the game of, as you say, life and death in Virginia and in the South. He was satisfied. I don't think he believed he had much of an alternative, and he carried himself with a grace and a certain degree of lovingness towards other people in the world.
Yeah. So 1968, say then, I mean, that's just a glimpse of his background, which you've summed up very, very well there. Harry Edwards, who's been on the show before, was very instrumental in the John Carlos, Tommy Smith 1968 protest. And he recalled in a documentary approaching Arthur Ashe at that stage, at US Open champion, to come out publicly and support Carlos and Smith. And Ashe, his response, according to Harry Edwards, was, "Look, I support what you're trying to do, but that's just not my way." And there was another story of there was some town hall meeting somewhere or other, and Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, was there in the back of the room and shouted up to Arthur Ashe, "You've got to get more outspoken, Arthur." And Ashe's response seemingly was, "Jesse, I don't do it with my mouth, I do it with my racket." So yes. You might explain to us, across the 60s and early 70s, would he ever comment on race in a vociferous way? Did he avoid the subject altogether, or how did he deal with it?
I think that he never commented on race in a vociferous way, or did anything in a vociferous way. He was insofar as the Vietnam War is concerned, for example. But in other areas of his life, I mean, one sees reflected the fact that he was a lieutenant in the army. I mean, you know, he was an establishment man. Mm. He was placed on the Davis Cup team to represent the United States at a very early age. People were investing a certain amount of prestige in him all along the way. And he was torn between, you know, being sort of grateful to such people, who essentially were benevolent people, I think, and also and joining the struggle that was going on all around him. I think later on, the important thing is that later on, I believe, he wished he had been a little bit more of a fighter over civil rights, over the Vietnam War.
Right.
But he was not one to spend a great deal of time mired in regret. He did what he had to do. He felt that he believed that he achieved a lot for Black people, for the cause of civil rights, by his victories on the tennis court, by the way he carried himself. And I think he was absolutely right. I mean, I think that that it would have been a tremendous pity if he had sacrificed his tennis career, for the individual struggles over this matter or that matter in this city or that city, following this leader or that leader. He did what he did best, and that what he did best was play tennis at a high level and conduct himself in a way that his father would have been proud of.
Yeah, because I presume this is from the memoir you worked on together. He said at one point, "I was acutely aware at times that some people saw me as not having done enough for the cause. Should I have done more? It was hard for me to act when I could see that what some people wanted me to do would have clashed violently with the principles I had evolved for myself over the years, principles having to do with a love of peace, morality, moderation, and religion. My character was set in this way, and I would not change for anybody," is his general summation. And I know he regretted going to South Africa as well in the 70s with the apartheid situation there. But he did, by the same token, he did, it seems, feel discrimination acutely, Arnold, because on just being black, I thought of all the quotes, this is, this is one that kind of lingers in the mind. He says, "I do not mean to appear fatalistic, self-pitying, cynical, or maudlin. A long time ago, I made peace with the state of Virginia and the South, but segregation had achieved by that time what it was intended to achieve. It left me a marked man, forever aware of a shadow of contempt that lay across my identity and myself, my sense of self-esteem. I don't want to overstate the case. I think of myself and others think of me as supremely self-confident. Still, I also know that the shadow is always there. Only death will free me and blacks like me from its pall."
Well, those are powerful words. And they do reflect a truth. The truth is that if one is, certainly in his time, and perhaps even today, one is born black in the United States, one can achieve a great deal and never escape the sense of living under, in the shadow of a culture, of a nation, in which, some people see you as a full human being, but many others do not, and do not think that you deserve anything that is commensurate with your skills, your achievements. So yes, he lived with that sense of shadow. But did that contribute to his somberness? I've talked about this kind of somberness that he carried around with him. I think, and maybe it shows that I'm more of a pop psychologist perhaps than I should be, but I think it was of lesser importance finally than the fact that he was had been a motherless child.
Right.
That's simply my opinion.
Sure. Yeah. This somberness you've mentioned a few times now, was it unmistakable? Like, I mean, if Arthur Ashe had popped into our radio studio and been around for a few hours, would we generally have seen it? Was it fairly apparent that he carried this air of somberness?
I think so. I mean, you would have seen I almost said a massive dignity, but that would overstate the case because he never made a spectacle of himself, I think. But you couldn't help but notice that he was not a shucker and a jiver. He was not fooling around in any way, shape, or form. He was not flirting with anybody. He just was into himself, as it were. You knew that you had to push very hard before you could get to the inner core of this human being who was standing in front of you. I mean, he could enjoy whatever you had to offer and whatever, you know, the moment brought. Mm. But to me, he was always somewhat sad person. I that's the way I saw him, and I was with him for a fair amount in that last year.
Yeah. I mentioned the Arthur Ashe Stadium. It's kind of a difficult question to answer. It's kind of a cliched question to ask. But how is he remembered? What is the Arthur Ashe legacy, if there is one?
Well, that's a good question. I think to be honest, if were it not for the stadium and the U.S. Open and what the U.S. tennis people do on the Sunday, which is broadcast nationally in this country with children, were it not for that, Ashe would not be much remembered, and in some places perhaps he isn't well remembered at all. But every little bit helps. Mm. If you admire somebody, whether it be Shakespeare or Arthur Ashe, I mean, you've got to stimulate an interest in that person. You've got to preach his or her virtues, and there's so much competition for attention and much less praise in our world. So I never want to overstate Arthur's importance or his standing. But you do know one thing. If you know Arthur Ashe and if you have studied him even slightly, you know you're dealing with a remarkable man of remarkable virtues and achievements, given where he came from.
Yeah.
And he's an example to us, an almost unsullied example to us of the way life can be lived at its finest.
Yeah, because I mean, maybe I focused on the failings or the slightly negative points. Like Harry Edwards did also say of Arthur Ashe. I mean, he seemed to respect the fact that Ashe lived his life with that kind of quiet dignity as well, and said that Ashe ended up infuriating one side of the cause or another, and in most instances, both sides. You know, he kind of understood the predicament. But there were lots of good things. Like 1969, he sets up, he looked at basketball in inner city, underserved communities, and thought, well, tennis should be the same, and tried to, he was a founding member of bringing tennis to inner city kids across America, across the South. You mentioned increasingly across the 80s, he seemed to become more militant and was arrested outside the embassy of South Africa and outside the White House when he was very ill, like 1992, when he was ill AIDS. I mean, the way Haitian refugees were being treated. And then we heard the clip a few days before he passed away, certainly tried to play a role in HIV awareness. So you said he in your last answer, he's somebody to be admired. We might finish by summing up why for you admire him, the main reasons.
Well, the main reasons, he started off life under a tremendous handicap, the handicap of the loss of his mother, also the handicap of growing up black in a culture that thought so highly of itself and so little of him because of the color of his skin. He did not have grand opportunities to become a major tennis player, but he made himself become one. He took advantage of every opportunity presented to him. He tried to act in a moderate fashion, and you know, I was trained in the middle is truth, and so was he. I mean, I think in a way, in his own way, and try to steer a course between extremes at all time. He had profound respect for other human beings, and he did not, you know, use color as the principal criterion for judging other people. Not at all. He was optimistic. He was gracious. He was full of grace. The title of the book, I think, that we wrote, Days of Grace, which came from our editor, Jonathan Siegel at Knopf, is excellent, because particularly excellent, it seems to me, because it both speaks to Arthur's overwhelming graciousness and the grace bordering on elegance or embracing elegance, but of course it also points to the fact that he was living on borrowed time, and he knew he was living on borrowed time in what should have been the absolute prime of his life, the middle of his life, with all his achievements behind him and his ability to capitalize on them apparently in front of him, except that what was in front of him was death. And he accepted that as gracefully, as graciously as he could. And in that respect alone, he is an example to us all.
Yeah, that whole finding the truth in the middle is increasingly a rarer and rarer stance. But
absolutely,
I think we need people like that. And well, listen, Arnold, it was a real pleasure to hear all your thoughts and memories of him. I guess we'll watch events at Flushing Meadows and the Arthur Ashe Stadium with newfound understanding. Arnold Ramprasad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I enjoy this very, very much. Bye-bye.
Off the Ball
on News Talk 106.